Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham. Once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, Pylon Week continues with Vanessa Briscoe, the incredible vocalist of Pylon, one of my favorite vocalists of all time. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you'd like to get in touch with me, you can head over to the email address turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. And that is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. And he will get the message to me. Tristan also runs a Facebook page and an Instagram page for this podcast. Both of those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on their respective platforms. If you're looking for me on social media, I am on Twitter and Instagram at Left4Damien. If you're looking for a way to support the show, the best way to support the show is by telling all your friends about it, letting everyone know that you know that we do this podcast here and they should check it out, because we will have, you know, people from The Sopranos on, people from Pylon on, people from NoFX on. You know, we go all over the place with this thing. You can also support this show by subscribing to it and writing a review on your listening platform of choice. And furthermore, if you want to go the extra mile and support this podcast, you can head over to patreon.com/turnoutofpunk and sign up for the Patreon and check out the stuff we do over there. And thank you, thank you, thank you to all of you that do. I really, really, really appreciate it. Thank you very much. Speaking of support, this show would not be possible without the kind, loving support of my fine friends over there at Vans, who came aboard a few years ago and said, "Damien, we just don't want you to have to do it out of your own pocket to put this thing on each and every week." So they give me a little bit of money to help me cover the costs. And I got to say thank you very much to them for continuing to do that and continuing to support this podcast. Because what we do here, it's not massive work. It's not big work, but it's the Lord's work. The Lord being the Lords of Punk. Who would be the Lord of Punk? Penelope Spheris? Yeah, that works for me. Penelope Spheris. Okay. Anyway, thank you very much to Vans for all of that. On to today's show. Today on the show, Tristan Abraham did not book this guest. My buddy, Brady Brock, over there at New West, who is an incredible fan of music. He is really someone that, you know, works in the music industry, and you can tell just loves all this stuff. So he told me months and months ago that he was working on this Pylon box set and mentioned that there, you know, we should try and do something for the podcast for it. I immediately said, of course, absolutely. We got to do something for the podcast with this band, because as I mentioned last week on Michael, or last episode, I should say, on Michael's one, Pylon's a band that I kind of feel like, you know, I didn't discover or anything, but I kind of came to them on my own, you know, like I found their records used in a record store, thought they looked interesting, brought them home, fell in love with them, and just, you know, kind of went from there. I wasn't able to find very much information on them at the time. And, you know, I felt like they were, you know, kind of my own band, because none of my friends knew about them, and it was my own thing. And then fast forward a few years and DFA did a reissue. And at the time, I remember being kind of taken aback that here's this band that I beloved, that I had developed my own theories on where they sat in the musical landscape, and here's DFA Records, at the time a super trendy dance punk label, coming in and putting out their records. And I really felt like, I don't know, like my band was being taken from me and given to the rest of the world. And now, of course, I realized that, you know, that was an amazing thing to happen, because it really did give Pylon a chance to kind of be recast in a new light and exposed to, you know, a whole new audience. And here they are, you know, 10 plus years on with this brand new box set coming out on New West Records, and they're going to be exposed again and hopefully given their proper place in sort of the musical history as being a key band in leading to everything that kind of happened in the wake of punk rock. They are a band. I don't want to say, I'm kind of dancing around it, because you're going to hear a lot of this conversation happen with Vanessa in a second, but I really love this band, and doing these two episodes and kind of going back and re-listening to Pylon again. Oh man, this is one of the best bands ever. I love this band so much. Anyway, I'm not going to ramble on. This is a really fun conversation with someone who is a massive influence on me vocally, and you know, far more important people than myself too. And she is just so humble. Oh, it's such a fun one. Okay, well, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Everyone sit back, relax, and enjoy Vanessa Briscoe on Turned Out a Punk. Vanessa, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm really excited to get to talk to you and find out more about what you think about punk rock.
Well, I'm excited to find out, more importantly, what you think about punk rock, because as I was just, you know, alluding to off air, you're a massive influence on myself, and not just myself, like a whole, well, tons and tons of people. But we will get to all that in a minute. But first, we got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Vanessa, how did you get into punk rock? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Well, the first time I came across punk rock, I suppose, is listening to the Ramones. And I think that the year 1976 to 77 were kind of a dividing point in music. Mm-hmm. Before that, right before that, 74, 75, I was listening to things like Heart and Fleetwood Mac and Top 40 Radio. And also, I had a real sweet tooth for prog rock because of my first husband, Jimmy Ellison, who was later the bass player for the Side Effects.
Yes, absolutely. Rest in peace.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, around about 76, 77, I started hearing this music. I'd been a fan of David Bowie and of Roxy music prior to that, which is kind of, you know, funnels into punk rock in a way. Mm-hmm. But then I heard the Ramones, and the Ramones were so immediate and direct. And they had stripped it down to the essentials that it really made a huge impact on me. Then I think, I'm trying to remember, I was in college sometime in 78. I didn't go to see the show, but some of my friends from art school or the art department at UGA went to Atlanta to see, the Sex Pistols in Atlanta, and it was their first U.S. Show. For some reason, I think the first one had gotten canceled. I can't even remember why now. And, I remember the next day hanging out with one of my friends, Sean Bourne, who later did the screen prints for the B-52's first single, telling me, he'd gone to Atlanta, you know, the night before and seen it. And he was telling me about safety pins and cheeks and all this type of thing. And I was like, what? Oh, that sounds so gross, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I didn't really experienced the Ramones until I think it was January, February in 1979. They played in Atlanta. So there you are. I was right in front with my girlfriend, Rhonda Nell Fleming. We were both painting majors at UGA. And we stood through some bands that had nothing to do with the Ramones. Y38 Special was opening. I have no idea, but they were. Yeah. And, the audience area behind us at the Agora Ballroom and the Agora Ballroom in Atlanta was empty. And then they came in, and all of a sudden this big crush, rushed against us in front of the stage. And we wouldn't give up our spot. I had women trying to crawl over my back. Somehow I ended up in front of Joey Ramone, and he gave me one of his guitar picks, and it was a great show, but, we could have been killed, I guess. And then afterwards, we were like, well, let's go meet him. And so, we were kind of brave souls. We walked around to the back of the Agora with Jimmy, and knocked on the backstage door, and we said, can we meet the Ramones? And there was a guy standing there, kind of looked at us kind of like suspiciously. And he said, oh, yeah. And somebody from the band said, yeah, let him come on in. So we went backstage and met the Ramones. And I was asking them to sign my T-shirt. And it was really funny because one of them drew a circle around my breast. I was a little embarrassed by that. But, they didn't do anything weird or anything. There was no weirdness going on. And so, the year leading up to that, we had our own party band in Athens called the B-52s, and they weren't punk rock. They were just new music. At that time, we were calling things that weren't punk rock just new music, and they just took off into the stratosphere, and that's about the time, and you know, 79, they were leaving our town behind. Shortly afterward, I was invited to audition for Pylon. But, you know, the Ramones weren't really in my head about how I reacted to what they were doing. But that was my first exposure.
Going back to, you know, before you were kind of, you know, in seeing the Ramones and getting into punk rock stuff, like, where were you kind of discovering, you know, the other stuff you were getting into, like Heart and bands like that? Was it through the radio or through magazines or?
Well, you know, I heard Heart, you know, on the radio, and then I saw their album, and I just loved the fact there were two women in this band, you know, making such great music. One was the singer, who had such a range, and the other was really a great guitarist. And, you know, when they played at UGA, I think sometime in 78, I did go and see them. And then, you know, there were a bunch of us hanging around kind of outside, and their tour bus was there. And I think it was, Ann Wilson. Mm-hmm. She came out. I don't know if she was plastered or what, but she saw me. And I was wearing like this, just a sports shirt and a striped skirt. And I didn't look like, you know, these rockers around me. And she walked over like she was going to talk to me. And some guy from, you know, I guess a minder or stage person or something saw her like actually wandering over to talk to somebody. And he picked her up, threw her over his shoulder and put her on the bus. So I almost met Ann Wilson. We almost said hello. But, you know, I really liked what they were doing at the time. But, you know, their show was, you know, when I saw what was going on with the new music that was happening, it was like all of a sudden it just became something that was old. It was like more traditional. Like, and I love Jimi Hendrix. He was an early love of mine. You know, more like standard rock, but this new thing that was coming along, it was ours, and we really enjoyed it.
Were the B-52s kind of the first local band that you saw that was doing new music or punk rock?
Yeah, you know, before that in Athens, you know, I have to realize where we are, proximity, you know, to Atlanta and Macon and all of that.
Yeah.
I kind of miss, you know, Southern rock. But there were still bands coming out of Macon, you know, to play in, you know, the UGA Memorial. This guy was dressed in a long white Druid's robe, and he was dragging a cross, you know, that type of thing. It was, you know, it was interesting. But we also had the R&B thing coming from toward Atlanta. I remember seeing Cornelius' brother and sister Rose, and that was really good. And so I always enjoyed, you know, the funk that was happening. Mm-hmm. I didn't really get into disco. Disco was real big in our area for a little while, like it was everywhere. But it couldn't really hold your attention. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So what about like bands for like punk bands and stuff that were happening? Were there any punk bands happening at that time in Atlanta? Like, would you see any of those bands?
Oh, yeah. The fans yeah. were great. And they played at Atlanta, and they also came to Athens. And Michael and I were in a class that was taught by Robert Croker. He was a professor. It was like he knew it was going to be his last year at UGA. So he just threw it all in with the students, and he was doing all these things. Like, he made his paintings at that time by chance, by rolling dice or whatever. And the first time I saw the fans, they were playing at the gallery at the University of Georgia. And he was somehow directing them by holding up cards you know, like from a regular card deck, you know, you shuffle them and pick up one and they would change according to that. And I remember seeing them, and it was the first time I saw, you know, a band that was wearing, you know, skinny ties and, you know, there was just a real change in look. And those guys, and then some of the art students that I went to school with, Michael was included in that group. You know, I guess it was maybe coming from German punk or English punk or whatever. But, you know, about 77, 78, you were seeing guys show up. I remember Michael, after I made friends with him, he showed me a jam album he had, and I hadn't heard it. And I looked at the lyrics, and I was like, I don't really like these lyrics. I don't know what it was about them, but I mean, who am I, you know, who am I to like, be such a critic because, you know, really, I guess I should have been learning or something, but, you know, we were all, when you're young, you're kind of full of yourself a little bit. You know how that is.
Yeah. Well, also it seems like you're pretty versed in rock music by this point. So you've got your tastes, I guess. Right. And you're just like, yeah, it's not for you.
Yeah. I've been writing poetries since I was maybe 8 or 9 years old and been writing. I mean, that's my dirty little secret. I've never published or put anything out. And really, my mother in high school did me a big favor because she burned all of that stuff. And so I don't have to go back and look at, you know, like some teenage girl writing about, you know, what she thinks about flies buzzing around a dead butterfly or whatever. I don't know. She did me a huge favor. At the time, it broke my heart. But in retrospect, it was a great thing she did because I don't have all that past stuff like that burdening me, you know, with thinking I have to keep it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and where did you kind of go kind of from that Ramon show? Like, were there other bands that were kind of coming through on sort of like a national touring circuit at that time?
Oh, yeah. Well, I saw Blondie open for the Kinks, of course.
What a bill. Holy.
And that was a bill. I'm trying to think of who the metal band was, and that was not a really odd bill. And you know, I actually got to meet Clem Burke either last year or year before last. He came and played with some friends of mine here in Athens. Dressy Bessie had played, and then there was another band. I'm forgetting what they're called, but they were really good. They had Eddie Munoz and several other people in there, you know, like from the Plimsolls or whatever.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And I talked to him. He'd never been to Athens before. Never, ever, you know, but I guess a big band like Blondie, there's probably something that says that if you play a big city or whatever, a festival, you can't play within so many miles. And
yeah, radius clause. Yeah.
Yeah, probably something like that. But I don't know. I didn't ask him. I was just guessing. And he was really, really nice. You know, he walked all over town by himself. I think people just kind of left him alone or whatever. But I asked him about that show, and he remembered, you know, that they really hadn't had much of a sound check. And I got the feeling that maybe the other bands were that nice to them. And anyway, Clem Burke is one of my favorite drummers of all time. He's in my top 10.
Oh, absolutely. One of the all-time greats.
Yeah, he really, really is. And he's a nice guy, too.
So was the, I guess the Fans would have been the first kind of local-ish punk band, like, you know, obviously not local, being from Atlanta, but that had a record out, right?
Yeah. And they were followed closely by the Brains, who ended up with a major record deal, I guess maybe after we came into being, you know, on Mercury with Money Changes Everything. Which is such a great song. I think Cyndi Lauper did it too.
She does, yeah.
Yeah. And then, let's see, there was another band called the Swimming Pool Cues, and they were really good. They were awesome in DB. And then there was a band called the Restraints, who were sort of dangerous. We never played with them, but I think they had problems, some sort of problems or whatever, and they'd show up and people would kind of like freak out a little bit because they were a little bit on the dangerous side. for whatever reason. But they were always, I'm sorry, they were always nice to me. But, you know, that's like, you know, I'm like thinking, what's going on here? You know, heroin, knives, guns, you know, all of the above. I don't know what it is. But people were scared of them. And so, you know, coming through the country, you know, I did run into that kind of holdover a little bit in certain sections of the country. Like the first time we played Philadelphia, opening for the Gang of Four, which was in August of 79. I was like watching the band, and this guy comes and slams into me full speed and knocks me flat on the ground. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "It's called the West Coast Shove. It's the newest dance." And so that was my first exposure to slam dancing.
Oh my gosh, an inauspicious start to the moshing.
Well, I think you have to have a group of people to really make it work, you know, yeah, that are all real tied together. Otherwise, somebody's going to get hurt or knocked down or whatever, you know. I was kind of on the fringes, you know, when this guy just ran into me. And I think he was kind of surprised that I was upset, you know.
Yeah. Well, otherwise it's an assault. Yeah, it's not a dance at that point. It's just you're attacking someone.
Yeah, it's just like, it's not fun at all. I didn't like it at all.
Oh, what did the restraints sound like?
I think, you know, I'm just trying to remember. They were like, you know how there was kind of like that punk thing where it was kind of fast and it kind of had a 50s kind of feel to it.
Okay.
With the progression and a lot of shouting or whatever. But I don't really remember any of their songs specifically, but I know that I heard them. That we never played with them, but I know that I heard a record by them. So that would be something for me to look up later on and see what I think now.
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned earlier the B-52s and them playing shows. And from talking to Michael, he talked a lot about how a lot of those early shows were them kind of just playing in people's houses, like house shows. And I was wondering, like, what was the first experience you had with seeing a band play in that kind of setting in like a house show environment?
Oh, like at a house show setting. Well, it wasn't the B-52s. I'm not lucky in that regard because I saw them on their first club date. Mm-hmm. I'm really going to have to scratch my head and really think about it because, besides the B-52s, there weren't a whole lot of house shows other than in art school when we got a single or a record from Chapter 3 Records, which was our favorite local record store at the time, that got in all of the newest stuff, you know, like from New York and London and Germany and California and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We would share them, you know, like we'd bring a six pack and some of our singles and records and we'd take turns playing our records. And that kind of carried over to where we had, you know, the students would get together and have house parties. Like probably the most famous one is our Professor Robert Croker, who had the 24-hour party, which lasted 24 hours. And it really did. So, yeah, you know, and a lot of that was just spinning vinyl. There weren't bands playing, you know, per se at that point. Later on, you know, when we started playing, we played a lot of house parties at first. And as new bands came onto the scene, you know, like I saw OOK the first time they played in somebody's kitchen. You know, there were maybe 15, 20 people there. And the basis that me and Michael just loved them, we asked them to come and open for us in New York. And I don't think that played, that was their first time playing. They were just so great. You know, a lot of bands in Athens started out playing house parties and Pylon did too. So,
mm-hmm. Like, it feels like that's like, you know, and that's such a staple of punk rock, like the basement show. But, you know, this has got to be one of the first kind of instances of these types of shows happening or the Athens scene.
Well, I don't know. You know, surely it happened somewhere else. We couldn't have thought of that, surely.
I mean, in a punk rock context, like obviously, you know, like going back to folk music, people have been playing in other people's living rooms. And, you know, since the invention of music, I guess people have been playing in other people's dwellings. But, you know, like in a punk rock setting, it feels like these would have been some of the first sort of like DIY punk shows kind of born out of necessity, because you, from the sounds of it, you know, there weren't venues for you to play.
No, there really weren't any venues for us to play. You know, there were some venues, but, you know, like Last Resort, where the Bees have played, you know, that tended to be more like a coffee house, or have comedians, or Sun Ra played there, or, you know, Steve Martin came through there. coffee house lady who named Elizabeth, I saw her several times. She was barefoot songstress with a acoustic guitar, that kind of thing. But, you know, as far as, you know, yeah, and most of the other venues, like the B&L Warehouse, usually they would have band come in for a week, and it was probably a cover band like Choice who would play all of these songs that the fraternities liked. And they had Archie Bell on the drills. He wrote some of the songs that the fraternities like, you know, like Tighten Up. It's kind of a holdover from the North Carolina beach music scene. That was probably the original beach music scene, which predated the West Coast beach music scene.
Really?
And the dance that was popular, this kind of centered, you know, somewhere around Charleston and the South and North Carolina coast, was a thing called the shag. And you'll just have to look that up and see. It's a simple dance that anybody can do. And I mean, even to this day, there are people, you know, and even younger people coming up, you know, in that area and certain circles, they still do the shag, you know?
Mm-hmm. I had no idea. That's amazing. Like it's funny because it is such a, you know, a musical hotbed, specifically Athens later on, right, where it becomes like the center of the rock universe for a time.
Well, sure. And, you know, going back, you know, we had music coming through here forever because it's a college town. People were drawn to play, you know, James Brown used to come here and play fraternity parties.
That's awesome.
Little Richard too.
Yeah.
You know, so you look back in the 50s and 60s, and then, you know, there was a band called the Jesters who were very popular, who had about 11, 12, 15 people in this band. They had saxophones and guitars and drums and, you know, all that kind of business. And they played a lot of soul music. Soul music was very popular, R&B, you know, just part of, you know, the background of what made our state so great and rich with music to start with. And then in the Appalachians, you know, we had the hillbilly and the bluegrass music and then the country music. So we've always had music here in Georgia. You know, thinking back to my childhood, listening to my mom talk about growing up, it was not uncommon to have a country acts come through and play at the school, or she saw the Carter family at her schoolhouse when she was a little girl come through and play, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's maybe punk is new, but to like country music is old, you know. They were out there playing on the back of flatbed truck at the local drive-in and all of that. So it's just whatever your, you know, your knowledge of it is, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on that both me and you don't know about, but it might have influenced where we are, where our place is, you know?
Oh, absolutely. But I think that's the thing is also like, you know, the influence that your bands had, you know, like that scene where all of a sudden this music was put on not just a national stage, but an international stage. Like, you know, you toured Canada, like, you know, where I'm sitting right now, you know, you toured England, and now, you know, the records have gone all over the world since then. And not to undercut, like, obviously some of these artists definitely got international, but, you know, it's amazing how your little scene went from like living rooms to stadiums in the case of some of the bands that came out of it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I go, you know, I played Primavera last year with my band, Pylon Reenactment Society. And we were one of two Georgia acts invited to perform. And we played one of the smaller venues. It was like only, I guess, 2,000 people or whatever. But I was amazed. There were people from Italy, Germany, Iceland, you know, England, who knew who we were. And there were people who had moved from the United States to Spain and were living in Barcelona that came to see us specifically. So it was kind of a real eye-opener. And then running into a couple of younger bands there who really liked Pylon, or they liked, they knew the musicians who were in my band, you know, like Jason Neesmith and Kay Stanton played with their band Casper and the Cookies. And so, you know, there was just, I was like kind of, wow, people in Spain know who Pylon are. It just kind of freaked me out. I had no idea. And then we were written up and, you know, like a tag and online fanzine, and I had to get it translated. But, you know, there's Google Translate now. So yeah. I was like, wow.
No, it's well, because your band is so unique, you know, like, and your voice is so unique, and you just had it's amazing. The music's amazing. So it stands the test of time. And of course, it transcends language and borders.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they really get it. I tell you, you know, I was just really surprised that people remembered us, much less wanted to still see us. And then the band who played before us was a band, you say you're from Canada, Chandra. Oh, now, yeah. Most of her band is from Canada, and I really love talking to them. And we had plans earlier this year. We were going to toured the southeastern United States, and I just finished booking it when COVID hit, so it was never even announced. So we hope to get to do that again someday.
Well, yeah, no, I you know, and hopefully make it up here again someday, because I know you did play here back in the day, though, right? Like on one of the early tours.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We toured there with the Gang of Four. I'm thinking that must have been Well, I've got on the Facebook page, I made some notes about the dates where we'd played and with who. I'm thinking that maybe 80, we toured with the Gang of Four through the Midwest into Canada. And then we went back again on our own. And then when we played with the B-52s, we opened for the B-52s. And where is Queens Road? Is that
Queen Street in Toronto?
Yeah, yeah. So there was that's where the place was. It was some big auditorium or venue or whatever. We opened for them there. And, yeah, so we've been to Canada several times. Let's see, we played, where is the, capital of,
Ottawa.
Ottawa. Yeah. So we played Ottawa, and I was joking. We Ottawa, but we Canada. I made that one up. And is there Ottawa City or
Quebec City?
Quebec City, no. But we played Montreal and Toronto and one other city there with the Gang of Four, and we definitely played Toronto with the B-52s, and we also played Toronto. You know, was just on our own. But I think that was maybe one of our lowest attended gigs ever. There's some guy, you know, he keeps contacting me from time to time. He says, do you remember? I was one of the two people there. And I was like, yeah, yeah, I do. I do. Thank you for being there.
You and, never forget those gigs. Those ones are the ones that stay with you for the rest of your life.
Well, we didn't mind. I mean, we always, we didn't care. It didn't matter how many people were there. I think also one time we played Las Vegas, and there was a fairly decent audience there. And the opening band were really new wave, like the opening band's lead singer had on a giant canary yellow jacket. And, you know, he was like shining a spotlight on the crowd. And then, you know, they were very popular. And when they finished, he said, "Party's at our house." And the whole audience, except for two people, left with him. Oh. And I was like, really?
Okay, what a jerk. Right. Oh, my gosh.
And so we were like, well, let's just have fun. So we had fun. And there were two people there that were two women. One was in a wheelchair and one was with, lady was with her. And then after the show, we went out and, of course, to talk to them. And it turned out the lady had in the wheelchair had broken her back and had a spinal cord injury and had been at the Shepherd Spinal Center in Atlanta. And the nurses, because she was a young woman, would put it on the college radio stations for her. You know, while she was there laying on her back. Wow. And she became a Pylon fan. And so that was a lot of fun. I forget why I didn't go. Maybe they wouldn't, you know, I just decided, you know, there's not enough room in this car. And I went back to the hotel. But the guys rode all over Las Vegas with her. She had a convertible, you know, with hand controls and everything. They had the best time. So we did that show for her.
What an amazing story to find out afterwards, too. It's like, wow, like what a... You know, the fact that you, you know, had a role in this person's recovery, you know.
Yeah, or at least, you know, kept her mind off everything for a few minutes, you know. But she really liked us, so that was cool.
So did you tour the West Coast? Did you fly out there and tour, or did you tour out from it from Georgia?
Well, when Pylon first toured the West Coast, we went to California. I want to say it was early 1981. And our van, for some reason, ended up having problems with the, you know how the transmission, I guess. So you couldn't put it in reverse, and it did do all the speeds. You know, it was on the stick, so they had made up this like little thing that they said. I never drove the van. You know, just go ahead and say that. They always made a point of parking so that they could drive out instead of having to back out. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if we had to stop for gas or go to the bathroom or whatever. And so, we made it all the way to California, and, we got to Los Angeles, and it was right next to where their La Brea tar pits are, because I know the van was broken down and I saw a sign with an arrow in it that said La Brea tar pits. Yeah. And we were broke down practically in front of like a garage. And, you know, I mean, how lucky is that? So we're like thinking, well, how are we going to get around? We got out here. One of them came back and said, oh, it's going to be 2 days at least before they can get it fixed. And so we said, I guess we need to go rent a car. So we looked across the road there, across like 5 or 6 lanes of traffic, and there's this big car rental place. It's in one of those round glass 60s looking buildings, you know, that has cars on displays. And it's a big place, I forget what it's called. And so let's go over there and rent it. And we had cash with us. We saved up money to do this tour, and we walked over there, and there was a young woman. She had red hair and freckles, and she was like at a desk. And we said, excuse me, we need to rent a station wagon, a car, a van or something. Our van is broken down. And she said, sure, I can set you up. And she started doing it, you know, all the paperwork. And then she goes, which credit card are you going to put down? And, Michael and Randy looked at each other. You could just see their heart dropping into their feet. And they said, we don't have a credit card, but we have cash. And she said, no, you can't rent, you know, without putting something like that down as security. And somebody said, gosh, we made it all the way here from Athens, Georgia. Now we can't even get around. And she looked up and her ears just perked up and she said, Athens, Georgia. And it turned out that she'd been in a Jewish sorority at the University of Georgia. And she said, I'll fix this for you, okay? And I found out, you know, like, you know, was started talking to us and stuff. So she got us all fixed up and we gave her cash and, you know, of course, got it right back to her and everything. So she didn't get in trouble with whoever she was working with. But that was so funny. It seems like almost everywhere we've went, we've run into, you know, people from Georgia or people that are really nice who've gone out of their way to help us. You know, I can't really, you know, downplay that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really been a big factor in how we managed to survive on the road, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's funny because, like, you know, I talked once again to Michael about this, but, you know, you hear about Black Flag and DOA on the West Coast getting a lot of credit for being the bands that were kind of like setting up the network, you know, on how bands tour. But that's kind of what you're, you know, yourselves are doing on the East Coast, you know, like in, you know, going from town to town, kind of building this sort of like, you know, relying on the kindness of strangers to get to the next gig type thing, but just kind of like building the network that, you know, bands like myself still use today, you know, like it's something that became kind of a part of being a DIY band.
Oh yeah. And that's, it's still out there. I mean, you know, at a certain point we stopped sleeping on people's floors, but, you know, you know, Michael had a Rolodex at one point that, he would write down, you know, back then there were no cell phones. So he would write down all the contact information. He would write down the name of the sound person, the door person, something about them to jog our memories, a close place to get a good meal, where we would usually stay. I mean, heck, we usually stayed at the same room at the Iroquois in New York. We always asked for that same room, you know, and I think, one of us accidentally kept a key, and that just got sent over to Special Collections for that exhibit, too. So, you know, we like to be comfortable. I mean, we weren't, like, obnoxious or anything, but we like to sleep in a bed, and we like to have meals together and take care of each other. And we would always try to do something fun. It wasn't you know, for us, it was like getting to take a trip and it was being paid for. I mean, Michael jokes, it was like, we started saying we were tourists in the land of rock and roll. And in some ways that's true. You know, it really is, you know.
But I think that's like the best way to go through it, you know, because then you never become bitter and jaded towards it.
Right. I mean, you know, it should be fun. I mean, why do it if it's not fun? Or, you know, I mean, you know, that's the question that came up, you know, when we were breaking up. The guy who was booking us, because we wouldn't go on this tour with you two, said, why are you doing this if you want to do things like this? And we were like, why are we doing this, you know? You know, that's a good question.
Yeah.
Thanks for asking it, dude.
But you guys, you did play some shows with you two, right?
Yeah, we did two with them. Our agent had booked these shows with him, with them, without consulting us, really. And he thought we would be really excited, but they weren't really our audience, you know, but we knew it. We knew that wasn't our audience, but they were very nice guys. I'll say that. Nothing about it. But, you know, to keep from the booking agent having egg on his face, we agreed to do two. So we did two instead of six. And I think that was a tryout to maybe do more. Somebody said that we'd even been offered their whole first U.S. tour But, you know, that wasn't what we were about, really. And it wasn't that we were being spoiled brats or whatever. We just wanted to do things the way we wanted to do them. And we'd much rather play a smaller club where people were there to see us, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's why, you know, that's why to me you've always been a punk band, is because you kind of did your own thing the whole way through, it seems.
Yeah. And I think the do-it-yourself aspect, because we were very self-contained. We did our own graphics. We managed ourselves, all of that. You know, we wrote our own music, except for, you know, we did cover Batman and changed the words. And I think early on, we might have, as a joke, done Wipeout. But other than that, it was all our own material.
Did you all put the stickers on the cover of the Crazy 7-inch? You know, that, like, reflective holographic
fish? No, I think, you know, if I'd known that Danny wanted us to, that I might have offered, but I didn't know. But somebody did, and thank you, whoever you are, who did all of those. But, yeah, we decided that we'd like the sticker. I think Randy found it at Stucky's, and I have one. I've donated it to that museum thing. It was, you know, a prismatic sticker of a fish. And Randy was really into some interesting things for the time. He was kind of like a precursor maybe to the later hipsters. But in his case, it came out of a genuine kind of artistic appreciation from these kind of cultural things that people might look over. Things that, you know, maybe in the 20s might have been considered ready-made art. And one of those was stickers, truck stop type things, you know, the mud flaps, you know. Mm-hmm. He was into Japanese robots, mid-century furniture. You know, his dad was a guy who was a person. We'll see, what do you call it? Interior designer, but he was also an architect, so he would completely do over the entire look and decoration of a house. This is way before, you know, flip or flop.
Yeah.
And he lived in the D.C. area. So through Randy, I learned, you know, country girl that I am, I learned about things like Eames furniture and that type of thing, which are... you know, now more people are, of course, aware of, you know, the mid-century look. So I found out about those things through him. And he had, you know, he was like a high school. He had been like a skateboarder guy, and he had ridden dirt bikes until he hurt his knee. And his brother was like a fabulous skateboarder, Chris Bewley. Ended up, you know, winning some championships and whatever, you know, doing that. So they were cool guys.
Mm-hmm. Going back to, you know, starting with Pylon, what were some of your vocal influences that you're going in with?
Well, there's a lot of people I like to listen to, but really I have to say Pylon is my influence, because look, this is how it happened. When I first went in, They already had some songs written, and they gave me the lyrics. And I looked at them and realized that these words don't exactly fit this music. So I had to make them fit. And I had to make them fit by, you know, extending words, or, you know, making them shorter, or finding some other rhythm for the word or whatever. So I'd have to say the guys with the music they were making influenced my vocals, because, you know, the people I was listening to, I don't sound like them. I can't sing like that. All I can do, you know, is what I do.
Mm-hmm. What about the harsh vocal? And like, because you do have a scream at some point on the record. Was that like just once again something that you felt fit the music? Or is there like people that had harsh vocals that you were listening to?
Well, you know, that I think that also kind of came from the sonic situation. I couldn't hear myself. So I was just trying to make myself heard. And you know, it was something that kind of fit the feeling of the music and the sound. So, yeah, I do have a very sharp and a really loud kind of sound there. You know, the first recording engineer we used, Bruce Baxter, he was just kind of shocked. He said, well, okay, I know we're doing good when you're in the red, and we're going to just keep you in the red. And I was like, I didn't know what he was talking about. And then later on touring with other bands, the sound guys would go, yeah, that other guy can barely make that needle go up. You've always got it in the red. So I was like, I think that comes from, like what you're saying, that's a punk rock situation where I was just trying to make myself heard. And it was the way that I knew how to do it with that, you know, to project.
Well, I think your vocals are incredible. Like, it's such a, like, especially the yelling, the harsh vocal is such an influence on myself, you know? And I think, you know, you're, once again, you're one of the early people doing it.
Oh, cool. Well, you mean I'm the earliest Cookie Monster vocalist?
I would never saddle you with that. You are doing something far more nuanced than Cookie Monster vocal.
Well, thank you. Well, that's very sweet. Thanks so much. Yeah. My what do you want to know?
No, I was just going back to those early tours. Who are some of the bands that would be opening for yourselves? Like, you know, obviously you're going on tour opening for Gang of Four, but I mean, like, locally when you'd be playing your own shows, like, what kind of bands were they fitting you in with?
Well, it was bands, you know, whoever was locally, you know, wanted to do it, or the club found it, or this band found out about it, and they would ask to open for us. I think some bands, like just mutual discovery, would be like Mission of Burma from Boston. And we played some very early shows together. And then we both ended up playing with Gang of Four for this show that was actually, there was a party before it that was a release party for Gyre. And that happened in Boston. Don't ask me why, but that's how it was. And so it happened in Boston. And there's some people that were at that show that still claim that that is the best show that they ever saw. And these are people that go to show after show after show in Boston. And they say that show with the Gang of Four, Pile On, and Mission of Burma. So
what a lineup. Holy.
Yeah. Yeah, we blew the roof off that place, buddy.
Well, it's also, it's funny because, like, none of you bands sound the same there, but yet, you know, you all kind of weirdly fit together. Like, it makes complete sense.
Yeah, we didn't sound like each other, but maybe, you know, and you know, Pylon's vocals and the lyrics, we weren't political, but I think... there was something about the negative space that we left in the music. And also, we were all just a bunch of nerdy people, you know, that were fun and just liked to hang out together. So it made perfect sense to me, you know, at the time.
What are your memories of going to England for that brief tour that you did over there?
Oh, okay. Well, we were playing mostly with the band from over there called Medium, who are considered a post-punk fan, you know, band. And we played with them probably most of that tour, except for a few shows. They were very, very good. I think they had a compilation come out on Cherry Red a few years ago. And then when Pylon, right before, you know, Randy died, we played in Los Angeles at a concert called Part-Time Punks, which was put on by Michael Stock from KXLU. They let us have their equipment so we could play at that show. I think a certain ratio were the headliner, and then we were, like, below that. And, you know, at first they were trying to say, hey, we want you to be the headliner. And we're like, no, you know, because we didn't think anybody knew anything about us out there or would even care or anything. And, you know, we came out there on the stage and I had my head down. I was just trying to focus. And Randy hit the opening chord of some song. And this roar went up from the audience. I've never heard anything like that before. And I was like, they know the song. I can't believe it, you know. And because they were all so much younger than us. And that show was just totally great.
Mm-hmm. Well, it shows the staying power, too, of the music, right? Like the fact that here we are all these years later, all these bands you've influenced later. And it still impacts.
Yeah, and I have to credit the DJs who would DJ at this particular club, the Echoplex in Los Angeles, because they've been playing our music for several years, as had James Murphy, mm-hmm. you know, not known to me at the time. You know, here I am. I'm a registered nurse. I was a registered nurse for 21 years, and I went out, but I'm kind of in my own domestic bubble. You know, I'm not like reading trade magazines or, you know, reading DJ posts or anything. I don't know, you know, what people are doing. It was very eye-opening to me. I had no idea.
Yeah. Well, I even when that DFA reissue came out, you know, a few years ago, I, who was paying attention to everything that was going on at the time, was shocked. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, like, you know, I never even would have thought like that Pylon would have had as much impact on someone like James Murphy as it did on myself. But I guess it shows that, like, you know, once again, it's a band that's so different that different people listening to it are going to get, you know, different things out of it.
Yeah. And we have very loyal fans who have followed us through this whole process, you know. It's just amazing, you know. You would think they would have given up on us by now. Because, you know, we were bound for the dustbin of glory. You know, we really were. But we've been championed a few times, you know, like by REM and by Athens, Georgia Inside Out, and then by, you know, bands like, oh, and the B-52s, and you know, these festivals and whatnot, and James Murphy, and then DFA, and now New West Records. You know, I just did not have a clue that it would be like this. But I did know that our product was not available. And so, you know, it's been, you know, probably 9 or 10 years ago, I started thinking, we need to look at vinyl reissues. And I've been working to get our rights back to our music and publishing together. I had some really good friends along the way, like Philip Walden Jr. His dad owned Capricorn Records, but he was an entertainment lawyer, and he was a Pylon fan. He helped me get the publishing companies for Pylon done and get our rights back to our music, and set up an LLC. You know, all the unglamorous things, you know, that nobody really is interested in. But you know what? If you don't take care of your business, there's always somebody who's going to be willing to do that. So younger bands, listen up, take care of your business.
Yeah. Definitely. Well, and it's so awesome that it's coming out as a box set, you know, because it's just like, you know, here I have all the originals, but I'm going to get the box set because there's other stuff to get, and there's a book, and it just feels like so epic.
Yeah, it was that book too. The label, Brady Brock, who is the vice president of publicity there, but he championed for us to get signed there. And he's the executive producer. He was insisting that we do a book. And at first, Michael wasn't envisioning something on the scale. But Michael and Curtis and I have been talking about donating our ephemera to UGA for years. And it just kind of seemed overwhelming. But this made us go through that stuff. And, you know, some of it got photographed. I mean, actually, New West were kind of freaked out. Well, not freaked out, it's not the right word. Well, they were surprised that we had kept so much stuff. We had a lot of stuff, and Michael and I weren't even the, what do you call it, the archivist for the band. Randy was that, but he had passed away, and his stuff, his family has, and they haven't had a chance to go through all of it, although they gave us quite a bit of stuff, to look at. But, that book, that process of that, and then he said, you need to have a history in here, and he hired a writer. He talked to us, and it was the same one who did the history and the Glands box set to kind of give an overview to people that don't know anything about Pilot, yourself or people who've been following us a long time. So I was like, well, okay, that's cool. Yeah, okay, we'll do it. We'll get the story straight, because sometimes it's kind of been embroidered on, or things have been left out. So it was kind of fun to tell the whole story.
Yeah, and it's also, it helps to kind of have that story put together and laid out for people, because, the fact that here's a band that, was championed by the B-52s, influenced REM, influenced LCD sound system, influenced all these punk bands as well, and dance punk bands and new wave bands and punk, it's a lot to take in. So you kind of need someone to put it down into text form.
Yeah, where we came from, our humble beginnings,
Yeah. But it's building a scene, and it's so awesome, to see how, the music that you played and the scene you were a part of changed that city, Athens, is a different place because of your bands than it was before your bands.
I hopefully in a good way. Right now, a lot of these venues are struggling, of course, because they're shut down. They're doing the right thing. I hope they come back. I really do. Yeah. It'd be a shame to see some of those go down. Some of them have already gone down, which I played recently, throughout the Southeast with the Pylon Reenactment Society. I was like, gosh, that's such a shame, because that was such a nice club, those people were so nice. So it's heartbreaking.
It definitely is. And I think, hopefully, it all, as you say, comes back, because it was something that was built, by people and bands over these years that still provides an outlet for people and still provides an infrastructure for young bands to play, because there are venues now that cater to younger music and will kind of like give new artists a chance.
Yeah. The give them, to have the young people on the scene. That's always been important to me, to see that happening. Because Athens, like a lot of towns, it's like a lab, really, where you can pretty much do anything you want to do, within, legalities or whatever on stage. And, people will watch you, saw a box on stage and, beat at it with a hammer, and they'll like smile and go, oh yeah, I remember being young, or they'll think it's really exciting because they've never seen it before. But, they gotta have that place, that creativity. But it just upsets me in a lot of ways that is not really supported by the government here. Hopefully it will be,
Yeah, because these are like, these bands change communities, they're important. These artists change communities, and I think Athens is a perfect example about why arts needs to be supported.
Yeah, the arts, definitely all the arts, they're important, and not everybody sees that. They only see the monetary, aspect of something. But kids that play music, they might not do that forever, but it changes their brains, the way they look at things. I think it makes them smarter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. Yeah, no, I 100% agree. I think, this has been an amazing conversation. If you ever want to come back here, the door is always open because I would love to talk to you more.
Well, that would be awesome. Well, I'd like that. You're a lot of fun to talk to. I hope you can edit this down into something you can use.
Oh, no, this is what are you talking about? This is an all gold. The only thing I'm going to edit together is the parts where we got disconnected. I think everything else is perfect. Before I let you go, I just kind of wanted to talk to you, you know, about what were some of the artists that were happening back then that you saw that you kind of felt, you know, didn't kind of get canonized in the same way or haven't been sort of looked upon, you know, as favorably as time has gone on. Like, were there any artists that you kind of think have been forgotten about that were important to you that you saw?
Oh, gosh, I wish you'd give me some time to think about this. But yeah, I know there are some because I've forgotten them. Okay.
Yeah, I get it.
You know, I'll have to come back and talk to you about that. I've got to give that some thought because we've had so many good bands in this town. You know, at the peak, we had 350.
Wow, that's incredible. It's amazing when you go through like a DB Rex discography or something and you just look at all these artists or like, you know, Buzz of Delight, which, you know, went on to become Matthew Sweet, or like, it's just amazing how much stuff, like you're saying, but like that number is shocking even to me.
Oh yeah, it's a lot. There've been a lot over time besides that, you know. So many great, you know, artists and musicians in this town. So many. It's humbling. Mm-hmm. You know, it really is.
Thank you, Vanessa, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Vanessa will be back for a part two. Whenever she feels like, whenever she's like, I want to go back on there and talk more about the punk rock, she is more than welcome to come here anytime. And pick up that Pylon box set that's come out. Once again, designed by Chunklet's very own Henry Owings, an incredible graphic designer. And it's got an incredible book and the music's amazing and the ephemera in there. I can't wait to get my hands on one. I'm very excited about picking this thing up. Speaking about things I'm excited for, next week on the show, I am beside myself excited for the fact that finally one of the greatest to ever do it, the legend, a buddy of mine, a guy that I've known for years, someone who has actually been on the show one other time, but it was in a group episode, so you really didn't get to focus on this story, and trust me, it was worth the wait. Next week on the show, Uncle Keith Morris will be joining me. That's what we call him around my house. And I'm not just making that up. We actually do call him Uncle Keith because the kids love him. The kids love him. Anyway, so Keith is here on the show and it is a doozy. It is a doozy. You know, the Circle Jerks have just had their godly classic Group Sex reissued and Keith is coming by the show to celebrate. And it is a good time. It is a good time catching up with Keith. Oh, I'm stoked for you to hear it. So that is it. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous people matter. Protect trans kids. Protect trans people. Right now, as we all know, we see it every day. It is a tumultuous time in our world. But we got to stand up. We got to say, fuck you to all the Nazis, all the fascists, all these people that are just spreading hate, you know, and that can be in the form of showing up. That can be in the form of donating money to causes that confront these people and deal with issues around systematic oppression. It could also be, you know, just getting yourself informed, you know, talking to the people around you that might not be informed and trying to, you know, express what's happening right now in this world. Anyway, go out there and get involved. Because you'll look back on this time and you'll be like, I should have said something. I should have done something. And yeah, that's it. Go out there and sign your organ donor cards. I know, you know, it's a pain to worry about death and stuff. But by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them. So you're really just like saying, you know what? You just take some of the stuff away from me. I don't need it anymore. Just give it to someone else, you know? So there you go. Go out there and make your own culture, though, because before you die, you want to have yourself express the world in some way. And that can be, you know, painting a picture, drawing, writing, just just do something to kind of exercise those creative muscles. You don't have to show the rest of the place, you know, the rest of the world about this, the stuff that you're making, you know, just for yourself. Just go out there and make your own culture and maybe share it with the world, but maybe not. Maybe it's just for you, you know, who knows? And wear a mask. Wear a mask, please. For, you know, all of us. We can, you know, one day we'll be going to shows again and making more memories and be able to, you know, continue this podcast forever, because punk rock will continue forever if we all just get through this. So, all right, that's it. I love you. I will see you on the next episode with Uncle Keith Morris. Bye.